Hopping aboard a Zodiac and driving past icebergs and animals like seals, penguins, and whales was the highlight of my expedition to Antarctica.
Oh yeah, big one up there, yeah. Or is that a rock? Oh, is that a rock?
Getting up close to see, smell, and even taste this place was essential to my understanding of it. As Alex put it in the last episode, I had to know exactly what I was fighting for in this battle to defend Antarctica and the planet. I definitely found out. I'm Michael Hernandez, your host and tour guide for Change the Narrative, the podcast about innovation in work, life, and education. This season is a very exciting one. It's all about my expedition to Antarctica as part of my Lindblad Expeditions National Geographic Grosvenor Teacher Fellowship. In these episodes, you'll hear about the people and places I visited, how each of us were uniquely drawn to this place, and how the act of bearing witness changes how you relate to the world and launches you on a different kind of personal expedition. There wasn't one aha moment where I suddenly understood what's at stake here. It's been kind of a slow reveal. The exhaustion of travel and jet lag, the drowsiness caused by scopolamine patch that I wore to prevent seasickness, and just the sheer number of breathtaking moments made it hard to get my bearings, and I think I'm still processing it all honestly. So let me try to give you a sense of what's at stake. It was common to see pods of orca swim alongside the ship as we sailed, tinted yellow from the algae that coats their bodies. One day we got pretty close to humpbacks that were feeding on krill, and one surprised us by surfacing just 5 feet from our Zodiac and rolled over. It scared the shit out of me. A primal lightning bolt shot through me, reminding me just how thin that line is between life and death. But it was the ice that really did it for me. I learned that Antarctica is actually the driest continent on Earth, with an annual precipitation less than the Sahara Desert. So when you see those ice sheets hundreds of feet thick, just imagine how long they took to form. The answer is hundreds of thousands of years. Cross sections of glaciers are like rings of a tree, layer upon layer of ice, revealing the history of every year like a meteorological time capsule. And scientists take core samples to learn about the weather and the atmosphere thousands of years ago. Bands alternate between white, blue, green, red, and black ice, tinted from algae that grow in these harsh conditions, or volcanic ash deposited by one of Antarctica's 20 volcanoes, some still active. I'll share some sounds of the ice at the end of the show. It's only after these kinds of experiences that we might finally be prepared to listen to climate scientists and really get what they've been warning us about for decades. And maybe it makes it a little easier to take personal responsibility for fighting climate change and understand why we'll have to make some pretty big personal sacrifices in the very near future. But then, you haven't had these experiences, have you? Or have you? On our return to Argentina, I sat down with Zachary Brown, a climate scientist and naturalist aboard our ship, to get some clarity about all of this. Just a heads up, Zach doesn't mince words, and what he has to say is probably going to raise some eyebrows, like it did mine.
I've got a background in both the Arctic and Antarctic seas and how they're being affected by climate change. And I like to share that with guests, get us talking about this bigger conversation about not just what's happening in Antarctica, but how that affects our entire planet.
It's like I was really surprised on this trip myself, learning a lot about even krill and how the krill and the phytoplankton ecosystem is the foundation for everything, but also as even a form of carbon capture. and how significant that is. And I think oftentimes, you know, you think abstractly about how remote some place like Antarctica is, or whatever happens to be the Amazon rainforest or whatever. It's not in my neighborhood, and I kind of forget how important it is because I don't see a daily personal connection to it. And I'm wondering what you say to people who are in that same situation where it just seems so abstract and distant that it doesn't seem to apply to me.
Yeah, that's, I think that's part of the beauty of having guests come down here and actually experience it for themselves, helping us recognize, for better or for worse, that this planet is totally interconnected, and things that happen in one part of the world are going to have big impacts all across the globe.
Do you find that that's a tough sell?
No, I don't think so. I think people, at least on this ship, come here because they want to learn, and I think they're very open and receptive.
And I'm wondering the difference between physically being here and seeing it and witnessing it yourself and reading about it in a textbook or watching it as a documentary.
You're interacting with a colony of 100,000 breeding pairs of Adelie penguins like we did just the other day at Paulet Island. And it's like, oh my God, the scale. And then you might pull your Zodiac up close, but not too close to a iceberg that's 200 feet tall. One thing that happens is you have these really deep emotional responses to just the abundance of life, but also the scale of Antarctica. And you see these 200-foot tall icebergs that have in the past, some of them have been the size of states. And you're like, oh, now I also am getting an up-close and personal look at the scale of warming and how that scale can actually impact places as distant as New England or Washington, D.C. or the Bay Area in California.
I feel like it's so easy to become overwhelmed with the immensity of climate change and the task at hand and also what's at stake. And I think a lot of people just sort of tune it out because it's too difficult to process or overwhelming. What are some easily actionable items that folks can do to help combat climate change? What can each of us do other than, you know, supposedly recycling plastic bags and aluminum cans and things like that, that really make a big difference?
That's right. That's the key, is to elevate our gaze beyond the personal carbon footprint. The personal carbon footprint is actually a piece of fossil fuel industry propaganda. It is designed to make us blame ourselves for this crisis, and also to make us ineffective at taking action, because things like recycling and changing light bulbs and using reusable grocery bags, taking shorter showers, it's not that these are bad things, but they're just so clearly inadequate to address the scale of the problem. And the fossil fuel industry knows that, and that's why they're trying to convince us to focus on ourselves and changing ourselves, because as long as we keep our focus there, we won't change the system. And changing the system through collective action is really what's needed.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. Is this guy wearing a tin hat? I mean, fossil fuel industry propaganda? It sounds like a conspiracy theory, right? So I checked it out, and turns out it's actually true. Researchers at Stanford and other universities have been tracking fossil fuel industry propaganda that goes back to the 1960s. They have, in fact, put the onus of solving environmental problems on individual consumers like you and me, who often actually have little choice or say in the matter, since fossil fuel-based products, like plastic, are the only game in town. Okay, back to Zach.
So another tool that people can use is to think about and put pressure on the U.S. financial system, which is very regressive when it comes to climate.
Wait, the U.S. financial system is to blame? Fact check time. According to an annual report from a group of nonprofits that include the Rainforest Action Committee,
U.S. banks contribute the largest amount, 28%, of fossil fuel financing. Between 2016 and 2022, J.P. Morgan Chase, the largest of the U.S. banks, provided $434 billion in financing to the fossil fuel industry. Back to the story.
The U.S. financial system is really structured to favor the incumbent fossil fuel industry, when scientists have made very clear that what needs to happen is the fossil fuel industry has to contract as quickly as possible, not expand.
That's a really tough sell. Sometimes it's a really hard thing to do because people are concerned about my retirement, right? And they want the highest return. And there's a lot of financial, you know, burden. There's a lot of motivation to not do that, to just simply go for what's personally best.
I was just reading a headline yesterday that predicted the sort of cratering of the fossil fuel industry by the early 2030s because of intense competition from renewable energy and from electric vehicles. It's very clear to anyone with a pulse where the growth is happening right now. And growth is what really gets the attention of the investment community.
So this is really fascinating information. And I feel like you and I are maybe in similar situations. What advice would you give to us who are trying to honor the truth and where we need to go, with not offending our employers or, you know, constituents?
Yes, that is really sticky and thorny. And there's no question that in order to make change on the scale that we're talking about, I mean, we're talking about nothing less than transforming the entire energy system of the globe. We're going to offend people if we want to do that. And so because there's a lot of people, and some of the most powerful people on the planet, are profiting off the system as it is, and they don't want to see those changes happening. My point here is just that there are so many reasons to make this transition away from fossil fuels and to do it as quickly as possible for our mental health, for our physical health, for our children's health, for our climate, for our biosphere. So everybody can probably find a way in to that conversation that's not going to offend their employer. There's so much beauty in this world, and that beauty is worth preserving, and it's worth fighting for. You know who feeds down here in the Antarctic on krill? The blue whale, the largest animal that has ever lived. It would be such a tragedy to lose such beauty. And so I just encourage everyone to do what they can to bring our society, our political system, our financial system back into a more harmonious mode that respects life on Earth and human well-being above corporate profits. That's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about the profits of the fossil fuel industry and the financial industry and making billionaires a little bit richer versus life on Earth. Choose life on Earth, and let's get to work.
Zachary put a lot of ideas out there, so I've included links to some of my fact-checking in the show notes for this episode. But if you don't believe Zach, or listen to all of the other scientists telling us what we need to do, listen to the ice. What follows is a series of recordings I made of ice in Antarctica. If you listen closely, you can hear the secrets it's trying to tell us. Trapped in crackling air bubbles, tens of thousands of years old. In the rhythm of the sea lapping against icebergs, and in the calving of glaciers, when giant chunks of ice that have spent thousands of years slowly flowing down a hillside break off into the sea.
slowly.
Woo!
Oh, absolutely, it's waves.
There's a wave.
Look, here comes
the wave. Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's shooting up. You see that? And it's awesome.
This episode was written and produced by me, Michael Hernandez. It was created as part of my Lindblad Expeditions National Geographic Grosvenor Teacher Fellowship, an experience of a lifetime for which I am extremely grateful. You can find out more about National Geographic Education, the Grosvenor Teacher Fellowship, and tons of other teaching and learning resources on their website, education.nationalgeographic.org. To see photos of ice formations, whales, and other wildlife we talked about in this episode, visit our website, changethenarrative.net.